Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Our topic tonight was actually inspired by the Thomistic Institute chapter here. That is, I was asked to speak on this particular topic, and even more particularly, I was asked to give a talk about capital punishment connected to the theme of building bridges, which is, I take it, your theme for this semester or this year. When I heard that, or read that in Raoul's email, I immediately recalled a comment that John Paul II makes in his encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, which came out in 1995 and was the remote inspiration for my doctoral work. So I had been thinking about that question on and off since that encyclical came out or first came to my attention. In section 26 of Evangelium Vitae, John Paul II notes that, quote, signs which point to the victory of Christ over death are not lacking in our societies and cultures, strongly marked though they are by the culture of death, end quote. And the Pope then goes on to note in the next paragraph of the encyclical, this is a rather long quotation, he says, among the signs of hope, we should also count the spread at many levels of public opinion of a new sensitivity ever more opposed to war as an instrument for the resolution of conflicts between peoples and increasingly oriented to finding effective but nonviolent means to counter the armed aggressor. In the same perspective, there is evidence of a growing public opposition to the death penalty, even when such a penalty is seen as a kind of legitimate defense on the part of society. Modern society, in fact, has the means of effectively suppressing crime by rendering criminals harmless without definitively denying them the chance to reform. And that quotation is from number 27 in Evangelium Vitae. So in seeing opposition to the death penalty in our culture as he calls it, a sign of hope, John Paul II was introducing an evangelical take on what had often been seen as, and indeed had been, a purely secular rejection of this form of punishment. A brief survey of the history of opposition to the death penalty would tell us that calls for its abolition were rare and marginal until quite recent times. The punishment was regularly used in Christian Catholic countries, including the Papal States, up until their dissolution in 1870. It was on the books in the Vatican City until 1969 as the stated penalty for attempted assassination of the Pope, although it was never actually used, never applied. So tonight I want to talk a little bit about the secular case for abolition of the death penalty versus the evangelical case for abolition of the death penalty, because I think it's helpful for us as Catholics or just as those interested in Evangelium Vitae and John Paul II's argument to understand both what is common and what is diverse between these two points of view. And that's the kind of bridge I'm trying to navigate or look at tonight. So the secular case. In 1764, an Italian philosopher named Cesare Beccaria published a book called On Crimes and Punishments. And Beccaria was part of the Italian branch of the Enlightenment. So the more famous branches were in France and England. So think of people like Diderot in France and Voltaire or David Hume in England. But there was also an Italian Enlightenment. Beccaria was the first prominent voice in Europe to call for abolition of the death penalty. This is 1764. The type of arguments made by Beccaria are purely secular and are also very common today. Beccaria's case against capital punishment is based on his definition of civil society as a compact made by men who voluntarily sacrifice part of their liberty, part of their freedom, quote, in order to enjoy the remainder in security and quiet, end quote. It's this contract or compact alone, he thinks, which justifies civil laws, including laws that dictate punishments. But since no rational person would voluntarily sacrifice his right to life, it cannot be the case that the social compact includes the right of some men to take the lives of other men. In fact, he goes further and argues that even if someone wanted to voluntarily sacrifice his right to life, he couldn't. Why? Because we don't possess the right to take our own life. Hence, we don't really possess the right. We don't possess the ability to give away the right to take our life. We don't possess it for ourselves. So Beccaria concludes that, quote, the death penalty is not a right. And further, quote, it is neither necessary nor expedient. This kind of argument, I'd say minus the part about not having a right over one's own life, this kind of argument is very common today. And I think there are some philosophical problems with it, which I want to try and briefly point to. The first problem is that, like most Enlightenment political thinkers, what Beccaria assumes is that the basis of civil society is the social contract. That is, human beings naturally have sovereignty over themselves. These are often called natural rights. But they agree to bestow some of these rights on the government in exchange for protection from the violence of others, right? So they sacrifice some of their lives to some of their rights to the government. And in exchange, they get protection by police and other authorities for their own life and property. This, by the way, was a deeply influential view in our own founding. So the philosopher John Locke was deeply influential for our founding fathers, especially Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. So, I mean, to us, this is familiar, might even seem self-evident, but it's actually quite a different idea from the more classical Christian view of the legitimacy of civil society. And for that, we could turn to St. Paul. St. Paul argues that legitimate authority is derived from God. In the contract view, on the other hand, legitimate authority is derived from human consent, right? So it's a purely human sort of construct. This is not only a Pauline teaching, if we were to want to make the distinction between Paul and the gospel, which I'm not suggesting we should do, but if we did, we could also find this to be a dominical teaching or the Lord's teaching from John 19 and the exchange between Jesus and Pilate, which of course we'll hear during Holy Week, not too far in the future. This is from John 19, verses 10 and 11. Astounded at Jesus' silence, Pilate exclaims, "Do you not know that I have power to release you and power to crucify you?" And Jesus answers, "You would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above." Jesus' response to Pilate implies not only that Pilate's political authority derives from God, but even more that precisely his power over the life of his subjects is, quote, from above. And it's not denied that he has this power and that it's legitimate and that it comes from God. The derivation of political authority from above, right, meaning from God, is closely tied, in fact, to the idea that the state could have the power to take life. They might even be inseparable. I think they are likely to be inseparable. After all, if political power is a human agreement and nothing more than a human agreement, how could it involve power over life and death? How could that be? If, on the other hand, the political rule is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer, as St. Paul says in Romans 13, then, as Paul continues, he does not bear the sword in vain. So given that for Beccaria and others like him who take an enlightenment kind of notion of political society, this rejection of the divine origin of political authority, I think it should come as no surprise that such a thinker would also reject altogether the idea of the legitimacy of the death penalty. In fact, I think that was a reasonable conclusion based on his premise. Beccaria does not reject all punishments, by the way. And in fact, he makes much of the idea of long-term imprisonment, which as of yet, remember he's writing in the 1700s, was not so common as it is today. But he anticipated that as a reasonable alternative to punishment by death. And for him, this is a more efficient and more effective punishment. It's sufficient for deterrence, which he sees as the main purpose of punishment. And it may even be more effective as a deterrent. That is, the criminal may be more afraid of life imprisonment than of final but immediate punishment of death. So the first problem is that with Beccaria's case is the idea of the origin of authority being merely human and not connected to from above. The second problem I want to talk about briefly is Beccaria's identification of deterrence as the only legitimate goal of punishment, which also runs counter to the traditional view, which does have a basis in scripture. Neither the Hebrew scriptures nor the Gospels or St. Paul question the principle that, as St. Thomas Aquinas very succinctly puts it, punishment is due to sin, a kind of general principle that punishment is an appropriate and rational response to some sort of wrongdoing or evil act. And the scriptures also seem to assume this principle, for God himself is portrayed as justly meting out punishments to the guilty precisely because of their guilt. And of course, we could easily cite references from the Old Testament, but I want to actually, just to make the point that it's not only in the Old Testament, I want to actually cite Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira. Some of you might remember this story. Ananias and Sapphira deceive St. Peter and the apostles, and they are punished. In fact, they're struck down immediately after their deception has been revealed by God, right? The apostles don't do anything. And St. Luke tells us, great fear came upon the whole church and upon all who heard these things. Which kind of sounds like deterrence at first, but I think that would be a real misreading, because there's no indication in Acts 5 that anyone else in the apostolic community was contemplating doing what Ananias and Sapphira did. On the contrary, we read in Acts 4:32, the company of those who believed were of one heart and soul. And no one said that any of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had everything in common. So that was presented by St. Luke as the mind, the heart and soul of the apostolic community. Ananias and Sapphira were present among this community, but they were not really of it, right? Their hearts were not one. Their souls were not one with this point of view, as is demonstrated by their action. So they're more like the wolves in sheep's clothing, hidden amid the flock. And their action simply unveils their infidelity. Hence, the believing community is filled with fear when they see these two struck down by divine action, but not so much because they had been secretly thinking about cheating the Pope and were now afraid to act out on it. But instead, this is, I think, the kind of fear that we call filial fear. They were struck with fear of God, who reads the hearts of men and gives to each man as his deeds deserve. And that fear did not cause them to, become cowardly and afraid of each other, but rather to continue, be strengthened in faith, right? Filial fear strengthens our faith and our hope. So the conclusion I draw from this is that punishment is due to sin. Punishment, there's something just about punishment in itself, just considering it abstractly, even apart from deterrence or some sort of specific utilitarian purpose. So now we want to move on. Those were the two problems then with Beccaria's account. Even if his conclusion about the abolition of the death penalty is the right one, his reasoning for it leaves something to be desired, especially from the Christian perspective. So now in my second part, I want to move to the evangelical argument against capital punishment, which I'm drawing from primarily from Evangelium Vitae, but with some additional comments. So when John Paul II cites opposition to the death penalty as a sign of hope, what does he mean by this? What kind of a bridge is he building? I will argue that while he affirms the conclusion of thinkers like the Italian Beccaria, he does not subscribe to their premises. He has different premises. Evangelium Vitae includes extensive reflection on the fifth commandment. After affirming the sacredness and inviolability of human life, which is communicated through the fifth commandment, as well as the conviction that only God is the master of life, Pope John Paul II then goes on to note the paradox that in the case of legitimate defense, quote, in which the right to protect one's own life and the duty not to harm someone else's life are difficult to reconcile in practice, he goes on to say, quote, legitimate defense can be not only a right, but a grave duty for someone responsible for another's life, the common good of the family or of the state. And unfortunately, it happens that the need to render the aggressor incapable of causing harm sometimes involves taking his life, end quote. And that's from number 56 in Evangelium Vitae. I'm trying to unfold here the gospel, the evangelical reasoning that John Paul II is going to present in Evangelium Vitae for abolition or disuse of the death penalty. Now, to start with, we're talking here about rendering an aggressor incapable of causing harm, which sounds a lot like self-defense. And in fact, that's kind of the context in which the Pope places this discussion in Evangelium Vitae. But we have to note that philosophically, self-defense is different from the death penalty. Because in self-defense, at least according to Thomas Aquinas, you're not intending to kill. Now, you may, let's say, by exercising what he calls a reasonable force, reasonable violence against someone, some aggressor who's, say, coming at you, you may end up taking the person's life. But you don't intend to take the person's life. You intend to defend your own life, and you use as much force as is necessary in order to do that. But in capital punishment, I take it that death is intended, right? I mean, it's the death penalty. So it's a little bit, I would say it's a lot of a stretch to say that one could execute without intending death. Now, in fact, some of you may know this, there are some philosophers and theologians who have attempted to argue that one can execute without intending death. But I think that's very implausible. Death in the death penalty is intended as the penalty for the person's crime. And I think if we lose that, we're kind of creating this severance between the internal act, the intention, and the external act, like what you're actually doing, which is highly problematic. The more common sense, and I think philosophically tenable view, is that in capital punishment, you do intend death. Now, John Paul II was a philosopher and a very good one, and he was aware of this distinction. And yet, he chose to place the death penalty in the encyclical in the context of defense. Not self-defense, but societal defense, right? The community's defense of itself. So people have read this in different ways, those who have noticed it. Some have been tempted to see it as a move to sort of redefine the traditional meaning of punishment. In other words, to take punishment out of the context of justice and in the sense of retribution, and to say instead, well, punishment is really only about deterrence. That was Beccaria's view long before Evangelium Vitae. But I think that's also implausible, if for no other reason, than if you keep reading in the encyclical, the Pope affirms just a few lines later that, quote, the primary purpose of punishment, which society inflicts, is to redress the disorder caused by the offense. And that is also practically the same wording is in Catechism of the Catholic Church, number 2266. So, I mean, he can't very well say the primary purpose of punishment is redressing disorder and say that the only thing that justifies punishment is self-defense or deterrence. John Paul II adds in the same part of Evangelium Vitae, public authority must redress the violation of personal and social rights by imposing on the offender an adequate punishment for the crime as a condition for the offender to regain the exercise of his or her freedom. In this way, authority also fulfills the purpose of defending public order and ensuring people's safety, while at the same time offering the offender an incentive and help to change his or her behavior and be rehabilitated. That's the end of that quotation. So the purpose of punishing evildoers, according to the encyclical, is first or primarily to redress disorder. Secondarily, it's an act of communal self-defense, defending public order and ensuring public safety. And it also promotes rehabilitation. So punishment is more than simply societal self-defense, but it includes societal self-defense. So when the Pope goes on to say, quote, it is clear that for these purposes to be achieved, the nature and extent of the punishment must be carefully evaluated and decided upon and ought not to go to the extreme of executing the offender, except in cases of absolute necessity. In other words, when it would not be possible otherwise to defend society, end quote, we might well be puzzled by this. Because if the punishment is determined primarily by the need to redress disorder, why should this particular punishment, namely punishment of death, be inflicted only when it would not be possible otherwise to defend society? Why, with regard to this punishment in particular, is the scope narrowed such that we're seemingly not thinking so much about retribution here, but more defense? So to understand this point, we need to make a distinction between the justification of punishment in general and the determination of particular punishments. So this idea that punishment is due to sin or punishment is due to wrongdoing is a sort of justification of punishment in general as a whole. But it doesn't tell us what punishment in particular, how to respond to wrongdoing, and when and where and to what degree. St. Thomas says in his Disputed Questions on Evil, quote, it is manifest that sin carries the debt of punishment, end quote. But particular punishments belong to what St. Thomas calls determinations of natural law. So he says they're not derived as necessary conclusions from some general principle, but they're determined through the exercise of the virtue of prudence. So it's a specific kind of mental act that determines, like, this is the right thing in these present circumstances, rather than a rational deduction from general principles. It's rational, but it's prudential reasoning rather than a sort of scientific reasoning, using those terms in the classical sense. Professor John Finnis notes that, quote, punishment is the tradition's stock example of the need for this determinatio, this determination, a process of choosing freely from a range of reasonable options, none of which is rationally, meaning universally, superior to the others. So in some circumstances, this might be appropriate, some circumstances that. Given this logic of punishment as a determination of prudence, what John Paul II goes on to say has been well described as a prudential conclusion. For example, Avery Cardinal Dulles, the Jesuit, great Jesuit theologian, uses that expression in an article he wrote in 2001 in First Things magazine called Catholicism and Capital Punishment, which was the source of my title, actually. It's an excellent discussion. What I think of all the things I have read on this question, it's probably the clearest and most succinct and reasonable discussion of these questions. So given the logic that we've just talked about of determinations, prudential conclusion makes a lot of sense. And Pope John Paul II says that today, quote, as a result of steady improvements in the organization of the penal system, the cases in which capital punishment would be necessary are, quote, very rare, if not practically non-existent, right? So in other words, because we can incarcerate dangerous criminals for life, if necessary, it is not necessary to execute them. And taking away that necessity changes the map, right? It means there are other alternative, reasonable punishments. They are available. Whereas, say, you know, in the 13th century, when Thomas Aquinas was writing, that was not the case. Long-term imprisonment, much less life imprisonment, was not an option. It was simply not the mode of punishment. Exile would have been the closest equivalent, but that's hard too, because, you know, if you exile a dangerous criminal, well, then you just shift the problem onto somebody else's scene of action. And that doesn't really seem very satisfying. And especially in today's world, obviously, that would be ridiculous. Can you imagine? Well, I mean, the English tried that with Australia, right? That was, that was the last great attempt to use that as a penalty. So at a basic but very significant minimum, Evangelium Vitae teaches that the church has no objection to the discontinuation of capital punishment. The church has no objection to the discontinuation of capital punishment. Essentially, it's like saying to contemporary states, you know, if you want to stop using this penalty, which, by the way, by 1995, most Western nations and a number of states in this country had already ceased using the penalty. And the church is saying there's no problem with that. There's no theological problem with that. And that's a really important clarification. We might underestimate it because it might not have occurred to us to think anything else. But it's actually really, really important because the popes prior to the 20th century rarely had occasion to address this question. There was so little objection to the death penalty, hardly ever, in the wider culture until modern times, as I mentioned at the beginning. I should note, though, that throughout the course of Christian history, it was very common for Catholic bishops to, on the one hand, defend the right of the state to execute when needed, and on the other hand, vehemently argue for clemency in each and every particular capital case, right? And that's what you see in St. Augustine. St. Augustine defended the right of the Roman Empire to execute offenders, but every opportunity he had, if you read his letters, you'll see this, he would plead for clemency. He would say, wouldn't it be better, especially when he was writing to Christian judges, he would say, wouldn't it be a witness to our faith and to our love for our fellow men if we didn't kill this fellow? And he never said, so just let him go, or, you know, don't do justice. But he pleaded for clemency, an important theme, and not only in Augustine. But when the question arose theologically in the tradition of the church, theologians almost universally argued that there was no theological objection to execution. There's only one instance in the history of doctrine that I know of from the Middle Ages, 13th century, in which the death penalty actually came to the fore as an actual theological problem. And that was in response to a group, probably the sisters have heard of, the Waldensians. We learn about them because this is around the time of the founding of the Dominican Order. They were some of the folks that St. Dominic was concerned with refuting. But Peter Waldo, who's the founder of this sect, maintained, among other things, that the civil state had no right to execute wrongdoers, and therefore that civil leaders were committing mortal sin when they executed. So Pope Innocent III required the Waldensians to make a profession of faith. If they wanted to come back into the church, they had to make a profession of faith. And he added into that these words in 1210, quote, regarding the secular power, we affirm that it can, without mortal sin, administer the punishment of death, so long as the punishment is carried out not with hatred, but with just judgment, not proceeding hastily, but deliberately. So the Waldensians, when they wanted to be reunited with the Catholic Church, had to include that in their profession of faith. That's pretty limited. The church is defining against the Waldensians that it is possible for the civil power to use death as a penalty without mortal sin. Right? It's possible to do it without mortal sin. But that leaves entirely open the question of whether the civil power may abstain from this penalty altogether. It says nothing about whether one ought or ought not to include this as among the range of penalties or use it frequently or infrequently. It includes no conclusions about that. In Evangelium Vitae and in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, John Paul II makes the important clarification that the civil power may abstain from the death penalty, which means that this penalty, he's implying, is not necessary to the common good. It's not necessary to justice. And as I'm asserting here, that I think that's an important point. It's not necessary to justice. Some have thought that it was. But this is only part of what John Paul II says. He, in the concluding paragraph to this section in Evangelium Vitae, he goes considerably farther than teaching simply that the death penalty is not necessary. He says, quote, if bloodless means are sufficient to defend human lives against an aggressor and to protect public order and the safety of persons, public authority must limit itself to such means because they better correspond to the concrete conditions of the common good and are more in conformity to the dignity of the human person. So now we have to unpack what John Paul II is doing here. The judgment the Pope is making here is that punishments that are bloodless, so punishments other than death, ought to be chosen, must be chosen whenever possible. And he gives two reasons. First, the concrete conditions of the common good indicate this. And second, the dignity of the human person indicates this. The first is a little bit easier to grasp. So he says, among the concrete conditions are, quote, the steady improvements in the organization of the penal system. The prison system provides a reliable way of punishing grave crimes and protecting society from those who commit them. Judge Richard Posner once noted that it is only in modern times that the state has maintained facilities for long-term incarceration. Prior to that, as we mentioned, beyond exile, there were few viable alternatives to capital and corporal punishment. That was a quotation from an article by Professor Jorge Garcia from 2003. In other words, the situation is now so changed that in this country, at least, and in most other developed countries, capital punishment is in fact used rarely, even for the most serious crimes, where it's even still on the books. And corporal punishment, by the way, is not used at all. Second, so the first point about the concrete conditions, they have changed. So that's clear, I think. But secondly, the Pope says the dignity of the human person, that bloodless punishments conform better to the dignity of the human person. Now, John Paul II does not expand upon this remark to the chagrin of many, because it's not immediately obvious what he means by that, in fact. And just to try and get you to see this, consider that for many centuries, I mean, throughout the whole of the Old Testament and throughout most of Christian history, it was considered in conformity with the human good to punish murderers with death, right? So precisely because of the dignity of human life, it was thought that murder was such a heinous crime that the appropriate response to it was life, was to take the life of the murderer, right? So it's actually not self-evident that considering human dignity would lead to abolition of the death penalty. It has to be, it really has to be explained. So I think in order to read this correctly, we have to read it in the context of the encyclical as a whole. I found this helpful in preparation for this talk, going back to the encyclical in the beginning sections and what the Holy Father is doing there throughout his reflection on the gospel of life. In the very first chapter of Evangelium Vitae, we find an extended reflection on the story of Cain and Abel from the book of Genesis, which sets the tone for the whole encyclical. We are reminded that, as the Book of Wisdom says, God did not make death, and he does not delight in the death of the living. God did not make death. Who made death? Who made death? It was man, not God, who invented bloodshedding. Man invented it, instigated by the devil. The devil, from whose envy death came into the world, as Genesis 3 tells us. The Pope comments in number 8 of the encyclical, "Like the first fratricide, every murder is a violation of the spiritual kinship uniting mankind in one great family, in which all share the same fundamental good, equal personal dignity." There's the human dignity that he's thinking of. It's the spiritual kinship between one man and another. We are our brother's keepers. Every murder is like a fratricide. In discussing the events that follow the very first murder, John Paul highlights the need for this crime to be avenged. And that's an important point to note. God himself intervenes to avenge the blood of Abel. This is a quote from Evangelium Vitae, number 9. God cannot leave the crime unpunished. It belongs to God's goodness that he doesn't ignore crime, but he gives it its due punishment. And yet, God is always merciful, even when he punishes, as the Pope goes on to say. So even in avenging Abel's murder, so God does avenge, but he also shows clemency at the same time by putting his mark on Cain, lest anyone who came upon him should kill him. Right? Cain is afraid because he's sure that anyone who comes upon him will kill him for killing Abel. And God puts his mark on Cain. From this, we can see one reason, a very important reason, why the Pope might say that bloodless means of punishment are preferable, because they allow evil to be avenged, and at the same time they exercise clemency by not exacting the most severe penalty. Even if it is deserved, still, this is a powerful, in fact, imitation of God's merciful justice, which does respond to evil and at the same time does not respond as much as it could. It exercises clemency. This is an imitation of what Pope John Paul II calls the merciful justice of God. But I think there's an even more profound meaning to the exhortation to abstain from blood vengeance, which only comes to light in contemplating what the letter to the Hebrews calls the sprinkled blood, which speaks more eloquently than that of Abel. In the encyclical, Evangelium Vitae, towards the end of chapter 1, John Paul II writes this. This is number 25. "The blood of Christ, while it reveals the grandeur of the Father's love, shows how precious man is in God's eyes and how priceless the value of his life. It is precisely this blood that is the most powerful source of hope. Indeed, it is the foundation of the absolute certitude that in God's plan, life will be victorious and death shall be no more." End quote. It is not only that men made in God's image ought to recoil from taking the life of another image-bearing creature. It's also that in Christ, the Son, who is the true and complete image of the Father, God has united himself to the human race, and as a man has shed his blood for us, thereby obtaining the definitive victory over death. With each human person, We are now faced with the dignity, not only of an image of God, but one for whom Christ shed his own innocent blood. As we noted at the beginning, now beginning to wrap up, the Pope identifies the growth of reluctance to use the death penalty in our culture as a sign of hope in the midst of what he very clearly identifies as a culture of death, right? So most of the signs are not hopeful. It talks extensively in the encyclical about abortion and euthanasia, very discouraging signs. But in the midst of that, there are signs of hope, and among them, this growing opposition to and reluctance to use the death penalty. But I think then, given what I've said about the theological reasoning of the encyclical as a whole, he can't mean simply a sort of secular hope that, you know, well, we're all getting more humane over time, society's progressing, now we've stopped using these kind of punishments because we're a more advanced society. I don't think he can mean that sort of hope. I think he means hope. I think he means the theological virtue of hope, at least in an obscure way. The specifically Christian hope is a hope in Christ's saving action, a hope in the blood of Christ. Those who today reject the death penalty, even if they do so for reasons that are purely secular, offer a sort of obscure testimony to the fact that, as we hear in one of the prefaces of the Mass, God has wrought for us a remedy out of mortality itself. He took death, which is the penalty of penalties, and transformed it into an instrument of salvation. Now, I have to make this distinction as a philosopher, that this is not a demonstration. So you can't move from like the symbolism, beautiful symbolism that I've been articulating, to a kind of demonstration that the death penalty ought to be abolished. I think this is better understood as what the Thomistic tradition calls an argument from fittingness, not a demonstration. The argument is that this penalty, or rather bloodless penalties, better conform to the dignity of the human person made in the image of God and redeemed by the blood of Christ. Given that Christ has freely shed his blood to redeem us, no human death is untouched by this mystery. As again, the letter to the Hebrews says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. But it is Christ's blood which obtains this forgiveness. And this helps explain why, for example, Augustine, while he defended the right of the state to execute, consistently pleaded for clemency in particular cases. Among Christians, even already in the 4th and 5th century, there was already a sense that when alternatives to the death penalty were available, they were preferable in most cases. And now, when there are stable, and we should add, customary alternatives to the death penalty, how much more are bloodless means to be preferred? It almost seems as if the burden of proof shifts, because now the customary punishment is imprisonment, not death, and not corporal punishment. So in foregoing the shedding of blood, Christians, I think, give a most powerful witness to the saving blood of Christ, which is our bridge to the Father. One final note then, as a concluding remark and maybe opening up to questions. So I've argued that the Church has different reasons for rejecting the death penalty than the reasons of secular thinkers like Cesare Beccaria. The Church's reasons are grounded in the dignity of man as an image of God and in the redeeming work of Christ. Her reasons are evangelical. And precisely because they're evangelical, they're not always easy for us or for Christians to articulate in the public sphere. There are points of agreement, but the foundational principles are different. But I think even apart from the decision of whether to articulate this sort of reason in a more broad public context, it's important for Catholics to think and talk about these reasons, because we should be ready to give a reason for our hope when we are asked. A final note, I focused here especially on Evangelium Vitae, with reference also to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, as the major source for this teaching. I haven't even touched on more recent revisions to the two paragraphs that deal with the death penalty in the Catechism. I believe the latter are still in need of greater clarification. Like, we're only beginning to try and understand and clarify these revisions. John Paul II's thought has been around longer, and we've had more opportunity to reflect on them. But even that, I would say we are still in the process of assimilating and interpreting in full his beautiful teaching on life and death and its signs in the contemporary culture. So I'll end there, and I'm sure that there are questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.